live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a family dispute over the future of the legendary Levon Helm Studios is intensifying. New allegations of financial misconduct, competing claims over the venue's leadership, and ongoing legal action have left the Woodstock music community searching for answers. We'll find out about what's behind the conflict and what comes next for one of the Hudson Valley's most beloved music institutions. A proposed federal rule could put more than $50 million in grant funding for Ulster County at risk. County Controller Marge Gallagher says the changes would give Washington broader power to cancel grants and create new burdens for local governments. We'll talk with her about what's at stake. Plus, science stories with Joe Johnson and a preview of opening weekend at the Weekend of Chamber Music after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A high-stakes confirmation hearing is underway on Capitol Hill at this hour for Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche. The Senate Judiciary Committee is considering whether to give President Trump's former personal attorney the job permanently. In his opening statement, Blanche told the panel that his time at the DOJ has prepared him to lead the department.
17 months ago, I sat at this table as the nominee to be the Deputy Attorney General. And I told you that serving in the Department of Justice was my American dream. Since then, I have helped lead it, first as deputy and now as acting attorney general. And I'm here today to earn your trust once more.
Democrats are expected to press Blanche over the Justice Department's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files and investigations of Trump's political opponents. Blanche's confirmation could hinge on a small number of Republicans who have not yet committed to supporting him. Stocks on Wall Street opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported a cooling in wholesale inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 220 points in early trading.
Prices at the wholesale level in June were up 5.5% from a year ago. That's a smaller annual increase than the previous month. Wholesale prices actually dipped between May and June by 0.3%. Retail prices showed a similar decline last month, thanks in part to falling gasoline prices. Renewed tensions in the Strait of Hormuz, however, are once again pushing gas prices higher. AAA says the average price of regular gas rose 3 cents a gallon overnight, while diesel prices jumped by a nickel a gallon. Iran is threatening to halt all energy exports from the Middle East after President Trump announced a new blockade of Iranian ports. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Tokyo, Seoul, and Hong Kong, but down in Shanghai. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Security officials in Germany are warning of attacks by Iranian networks in Europe after a list of targets was published in a pro-regime newspaper. Esme Nicholson reports Tehran is accusing European states of failing to condemn U.S.-Israeli attacks.
Among the 13 politicians listed by the Iranian daily Hamashari were President Trump, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and the leaders of France, Italy, and Great Britain. The newspaper asserts that they will pay for the death of former Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Security policy experts within the German Bundestag say the retaliation list would not have been published without approval from the Iranian regime, warning that the risk of Iran's intelligence agencies using proxies in Germany to carry out attacks is extremely real. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 205 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. New York has become the first state to halt the development of large data centers used to power artificial intelligence. Governor Kathy Hochul announced a moratorium on Tuesday that could last up to a year while the state develops new environmental and energy standards. Hochul is also planning to seek an end to sales tax exemptions for large data centers. Lawmakers and regulators in dozens of states are weighing measures to limit their effect on electricity grids, utility bills, and local communities. England and Argentina are set to face off in a World Cup semifinal today. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports the matchup will be the newest chapter in the longtime rivalry between the two teams on and off the field.
The England-Argentina rivalry has had plenty of controversial moments over the decades, like the infamous Hand of God goal scored by Diego Maradona in 1986. And of course, in 1982, there was a war between the two over the Falkland Islands, whose sovereignty is disputed to this day. This is the sixth time these two nations have met at the World Cup. This time, Argentina is the defending champion, led by the 39-year-old megastar Lionel Messi, who has scored 8 goals at this World Cup so far. Meanwhile, England is playing for its first appearance in the World Cup final since 1966. Their captain, Harry Kane, and young attacker Jude Bellingham have 6 goals apiece. The winner will move on to face Spain in the final on Sunday in New Jersey. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Atlanta.
Stocks continue to trade higher on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow was up 163 points, the Nasdaq up 165. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We'll get to our stories on the show in just a minute, but first, want to check in on our summer fun drive and where we stand. And joining us now is Mimi Bradley, our Director of Development, with the latest numbers. Mimi, what can you tell us?
Good morning. Well, I can tell you that we're heading into the home stretch.
Yes.
We are at 85%.
Oh, wow.
Within $10,000 of our $65,000 goal. So, listener, if you haven't given yet, now is the time. Help us cross that finish line. Call us at 845-482-4141. Go online at wjffradio.org or make a gift on our new app.
This is a great moment in a summer fun drive because it means that we're in the final stretch, that final $10,000. And it can go pretty quickly if we start hearing from folks. 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org, or on the app. We want to thank Anonymous from North Branch, who became a sound supporter, who helps put that monthly total toward our overall goal on our summer fun drive.
Absolutely. Becoming a sound supporter is super easy. You don't need to think about it. Just decide an amount that you're going to give each month, and we just charge you every month. It's easy for you, and it's so, so helpful for us. It gives us ongoing income that we can absolutely depend on.
When we come into the fund drives, we plan for what we need to raise because we budgeted for the year. And if we have more sound supporters, we know what's coming in. We don't have, maybe have less to raise in these drives. So sound supporter is a great way of putting that money there in the foundation of this station. You can become one by calling us at 845-482-4141. Go to wjffradio.org or on the app. It's safe, secure, easy, and it makes us all that much happier.
Take a little stress off the staff, please.
Exactly.
And also, I did want to say a little shout out. Thank you to Jeff in Jeffersonville, who also recently donated online. So thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you all. Thank you, Mimi.
And
we'll check back in about the status as we continue on Radio Chatskill. Now, a bitter dispute over the future of the Levon Helm Studios in Woodstock has drawn national attention, with competing allegations from the venue's new leadership and members of the Helm family. The conflict has already led to management changes, canceled concerts, resignations, and legal filings, raising questions about the future of one of the Hudson Valley's most iconic music venues. Noah Eckstein is the editor-in-chief of The Overlook, whose reporting first brought many of these details to light, and he joins us now. Noah, hello.
Hey, Tim. Good morning.
For listeners who haven't been following this story closely, can you walk us through what's happened and how did this dispute become public?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're seeing is a fight over control of one of Woodstock's most important musical institutions, Levon Helm Studios. Levon Helm was a founding member of the band called The Band, which was Bob Dylan's backing band, and also had numerous hits like Up on Cripple Creek and The Wait. Martin Scorsese did a documentary about their last concert called The Last Waltz. These guys were legends. Levon started Levon Helm Studios and very famous Midnight Rambles in 2004 to try and pay for some of the medical debts that came with you know, he had cancer of the vocal cords. But what's happening now? So his daughter, Amy Helm, was removed from management in late May. And longtime shareholder Brian Perillo now controls 60% of the company's voting power, removing Amy Helm from management. And now this you know, Brian Perillo is CEO and president. Amy and her stepmother, Levon's longtime wife, Sandra Helm, still each own 40% of the company. But Sandra and another shareholder gave their voting power to Brian.
So the latest reporting from The Overlook includes some serious allegations from Brian Perillo against Amy Helm. What exactly is he alleging, and what evidence has he publicly provided to support those claims?
So he, in our follow-up story that was posted Monday evening, July 13th, we reported that Perillo publicly is stating that he's alleging that Amy Helm mismanaged the company, and that his words, he said there was financial malfeasance. He has not provided documentation publicly to support this, and he has not provided The Overlook with this documentation. But that is what he's alleging.
Has Amy Helm publicly responded in details to the situation here, any specific accusations? And what has she said publicly about her removal from management and this broader dispute?
So publicly on her social media, she hasn't given many details. She said that this is an ongoing dispute, that she is no longer a part of management, and that at a later time she will comment in more depth. She has, told The Overlook that she will be giving that interview to us. So we're excited to learn more about what's going on, because we still don't know. But in a court filing, she alleged that Sandra, her stepmother and Levon's longtime wife and widow, that she was vulnerable to manipulation and accused Brian Perillo of financial exploitation and elder abuse. Those are allegations, and Sandra Helm and Brian Perillo categorically deny them.
And what else has Sandra Helm said about what Amy is alleging, and then this change in leadership?
Yeah, so Sandra lives at The Barn, which Levon Helm Studios is colloquially known as in the community. It's The Barn. She's lived there since the 70s, the 80s, the early 80s. And she said that she wanted to give her voting power to Brian because she saw a thinning concert schedule at Levon Helm Studios, and she wanted programming to better reflect what she said was The Barn's rock and roll history. She strongly denied Amy Helm's allegation that she was manipulated, and she said this decision was that she just wanted new leadership.
And you mentioned that in the reporting that there are legal proceedings underway. Beyond the legal battle, what impact is this having on Levon Helm Studios as a music venue? We've already seen some postponed and canceled concerts, right?
Yeah, so we reported that Sam Grisman, who has a pretty popular trio, that he canceled his August shows. Sam Grisman is the son of the famous mandolin player David Grisman, who played with Jerry Garcia many years ago. And what we're seeing online is that there is an outpouring from musicians who have played at The Barn, who revere Levon Helm and his role in the cultural musical history of the town of Woodstock. They are coming out in support of Amy and saying that she does have a birthright to control the future of Levon Helm Studios. In a social media post by Brian Perillo, the now CEO and president, he said that is not true, that this is not a birthright. But it's really blowing up online, and it's sort of a sad story. You know, this town has gone through so much. There's such a storied musical cultural history here. The famous 1969 Woodstock Festival was supposed to be in the town, was named after the town, and all the producers of it were from Woodstock. So it's just a sad story.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about the cultural significance of Levon Helm Studios. It's always been more than just a concert venue, and why the dispute is striking a chord within the music community, and why so many people are emotionally invested in the future of Levon Helm Studios.
Yeah, I think it's just because of who Levon was and the importance that he had and still has in music. I mean, their music is just so good. You don't hear music like that anymore. These are iconic songs that you know, most of the members of the band were from Canada, but Levon was from Arkansas, and he moved to Woodstock in the 60s. And the whole band really, you know, Rick Danko as well, the bassist, they called Woodstock their home, and they loved it here. And it's just, people are very protective of that era of music, especially in this town. And they want to see Levon's daughter continue that family legacy.
Are there any facts that both sides generally agreed upon in this dispute, despite their very different interpretations of the event?
That I mean, I think they all agree that they want Levon Helm Studios to succeed, but they differ on the future of how it should be run.
And what are you,
and who?
Go ahead.
And who should be running it, right?
Right. What are the next developments you'll be watching, and what are some questions that remained unanswered as the story continues to unfold?
Well, I'm looking for proof of the financial malfeasance. I feel like that's a huge part of this that we don't have yet. That's just been, you know, playing out on social media. So looking for that, and then also anything that's updating on the Levon Helm estates with the guardianship point.
That's Noah Eckstein of The Overlook, the editor-in-chief of The Overlook. You can read more at theoverlooknews.com. Noah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Still to come, Ulster County Comptroller March Gallagher explains why she says proposed federal grant rules could have local consequences and what counties across the country are doing to push back. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Ada Peralta, and I cover Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean for NPR. Lately, I've been covering the U.S. strikes on boats in the Caribbean and the momentous news out of Venezuela. I prioritize bearing witness. Hard to bear witness in an open ocean. Hard to bear witness in Venezuela because we're not allowed in. And so the next best thing is to surround the story. We went to Trinidad, where we spoke to family members of who they said were fishermen who went off into the waters and never came back. We complement what you're hearing from Washington with what's actually happening on the ground. And I think that's really the important part of getting as close to the truth as you possibly can. NPR is committed to helping you better understand the world. Invest in in-depth international coverage today by giving to this station. Thanks.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A proposed change to federal grant regulations is drawing concern from local governments across the country, including Ulster County. County Controller March Gallagher is warning that a rule under consideration by the Office of Management and Budget could put more than $50 million in current and future federal grant funding at risk by expanding the federal government's authority to terminate grants and adding new compliance requirements for local recipients. Ulster County Controller March Gallagher joins us now with more. Welcome.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me on this important issue.
Your office says this proposed federal rule could put more than $50 million in grant funding at risk just in Ulster County. Can you explain what the proposal would do and why you're so concerned?
Yes. The proposal is to change the uniform guidance that governs grants and federal funding. And it has a bunch of provisions that we think are really concerning for counties, local governments, and others to implement. And they include things like expanded federal termination authority, where they can just terminate a grant after a senior political appointee doesn't like it at any point during the grant. It's going to have a new pre-award review and risk evaluation requirements that we think are going to slow down getting federal money out the door. It's going to have a viewpoint neutrality and event services requirement. so that anything that, not just if the event itself is covered with federal funds, but if federal funds are used to support the facility and an event happens there that the federal government doesn't agree with, and this is really concerning as an organization that manages parks and the Ulster County Fairground, you know, if some vendor at the Ulster County Fairground has a flag or a poster that the President of the United States doesn't like, that doesn't mean we should lose grant money that might have been used to, you know, support infrastructure development at the fairground, for example. And then kind of building on that, another concern is that the proposed changes would require entities that receive federal money and are a pass-through to another entity to manage the subrecipients and ensure that the subrecipients don't take any actions that could significantly damage the reputation of the pass-through entity, that would be the county, the awarding agency, say like Homeland Security, or the federal government. That's just completely unworkable. I can't oversee and monitor every subrecipient's, you know, social media feed, for example. And, you know, this new guidance would allow them to terminate a grant, for example. And let me just use, you know, let me make an example to explain what I'm talking about. We receive HEAP funding, right? We contract with a vendor to get that money out the door. They put something out that the federal government doesn't like. Now the county is going to lose funding because you didn't like how one of our nonprofit agencies said something. So it's really hard to monitor subrecipients at that level. And then a sneaky other thing in here is that it's going to turn this into a binding regulation, which means future changes wouldn't even require a comment period. They would just go into effect automatically. And, you know, this proposal would also have new, like, policy conditions and cost disallowances with undefined terms. So counties and other recipients of federal funds won't really know. This just provides so much flexibility and discretion to the federal government to cancel these grants that and funding streams that it really puts us in a difficult position. So that's kind of an overview of it. I know it's really wonky, and the comment period passed. One of the things I asked them to do is expand the comment period for another 45 days. I think we have other, you know, counties, towns, villages, nonprofits, businesses that would comment if they knew about it.
It is a little wonky, but it's important. Big changes. And for listeners who don't follow federal grant policy as closely as you do, let's talk about a few of these points that you've made in the overview. The memorandum of this this proposal says that federal agencies could gain broader authority to terminate grants. How might that affect projects already underway in Ulster County?
I mean, look, we use federal money all the time. We did a report on this in 2024, sort of looking at our total federal funds footprint. You know, we expend about $50 million a year. Around half of that is health and human services related. Everything from, you know, meal delivery for the aging to, you know, Medicare enrollment assistance. TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, you know, those are programs that people absolutely rely on. But even in the other areas, and I'm going to just use an example, we are building, you know, an emergency operations center in New Paltz, and I haven't looked, done the research right now, I'm sorry to tell you, but there could be federal money there. We have Homeland Security, New York State Homeland Security money that has gone into that program. Some of that money might be federally sourced, and that could put those funding streams at risk. And these are things that have already been budgeted and maybe already expended. So it's very concerning, this rule change, and it really could upset the apple cart. Now, I don't want listeners and constituents to think we're going to lose all $50 million. That is not really what I'm talking about. I'm saying each piece of this federal funding is now at risk because of these changes. And I think that this policy change, this rule change, gives the Trump administration the ability to exact political vengeance on anyone they don't like. And that's not how we're supposed to be running government. You know, there's people I disagree with all the time. It doesn't mean we cut off their funding, right? Especially if it's legitimate. And one other thing I want to say that I think was really important, we are, in our office, the internal audit function of Ulster County. I'm elected by the people of Ulster County to audit these programs and to make sure we have good internal controls. And indeed, we have audited things that contain some aspects of federal money where we found things that we thought could be done better. So we are already doing a good job making sure that there's not waste, fraud, and abuse in these programs.
And to be clear, this rule under consideration by the Office of Management and Budget is drawing concern from local governments across the country, not just in Ulster.
Absolutely. The way I heard about it was through the National Association of Counties that reached out to us and was like, hey, Mayday, this is a problem. And it's not just blue counties and it's not just New York counties. It's everywhere. It's going to be a problem for everyone because, as you've seen, you know, you have seen the administration withhold funding for major projects or disaster declarations based on I don't like the way they talked about me, you know,
yeah.
And that should not be, you know, we have the First Amendment here. We need to be able to speak our minds and we should still have access to federal funds, especially, you know, given New York State's balance of payments where we're paying a lot more in than we usually get.
Could this proposal allow the federal government to claw back funds that have already been spent in good faith? And how significant is that risk for counties like Ulster?
I mean, I am concerned that this one section of it, you know, the cost disallowance provision could allow clawbacks. I don't think, you know, look, it's going to require litigation. You did see the clawback of a substantial amount of money from New York City. I don't know if you recall that. It was for housing funding, and they took back, I think it was, I can't remember the exact amount, maybe $80 million or something that was just suddenly gone from an account. So, you know, this has happened before, and I think, you know, this does open the door to have that happen more in the future.
And you mentioned that the comment period has ended. You were asking for it to be extended. What comes next? How does this process work? Is it something that they can just unilaterally propose and adopt?
They're going to take it into consideration. You know, I don't know how long they have to change it. I think that, you know, they're going to get a lot of blowback. This is one of the things where, and I think that's why it was good that the National Association of Counties was letting us know that this is a problem, because we really need as many people as possible to raise issues, and people should continue to let their elected officials know that this would be a problem. I don't have the timeline in front of me, I'm sorry to say, so I can't say exactly when they'll go into effect, but I would believe it would be certainly by the end of the year if they approve it.
And so what's next for counties? You mentioned that at the national level, they're rallying to push back. What's next for you and for other counties across the country?
I think we need to work on our elected representatives in Congress who really have to, you know, now the ball is in their court to really pressure OMB. Our opportunity for comment has ceased unless they reopen the comment provision, which I can't imagine they will. But if enough congressional representatives put pressure on OMB and on the administration, then I think you could see changes and delays. So I really urge people to reach out to their congressional reps and let them know, like, this is a huge concern.
And just to remind folks again, which local programs or services could be most vulnerable if these rules take effect?
I guess the way to look at it is to look at what we spend most of our federal money on. I think that's the most helpful way to get a picture of it. And, you know, and again, a lot of the money that we get that we expend that's federal funding is health and human service related. TANF, temporary aid to needy families, being one of the largest chunks, foster care support, you know, a bit of Medicaid support that comes through the county. But then we have other things, you know, other projects, other programs where we're spending money to, you know, facilitate construction or to provide some sort of, you know, training and information. Perfect example, public health, right? That's an area where federal money is often used. So all of these programs, I think, if we're saying things that the administration doesn't like, are now going to be at risk for being terminated and potentially clawed back. And transportation is another area, right? I mean, here's an example. We have, in 2023, you know, we had $6.6 million in transportation, federal transportation money, right? What if somebody is riding the bus system and protesting Trump, or using the bus system to get to a protest, or standing over the New York State Thruway with signage opposing the administration, which has been happening in Ulster County, and they're going over a road that's a state highway or a county road? Are we at risk of losing money because somebody stood on an overpass on New York State Thruway and criticized Donald Trump? That's the kind of thing I'm concerned about.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier some clawback of money in New York City. The federal government clawed back over $188 million in grants meant to reimburse the city for sheltering migrants. Department of Homeland Security and FEMA terminated three shelter and services grants. That's Controller March Gallagher from Ulster County. There's more information at controller.ulstercountyny.gov. Controller Gallagher, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tim, and I hope everybody on WJFF has a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's Science Stories with Joe Johnson. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Michael Loewinger from On the Media. At OTM, we pride ourselves on cutting through the BS to bring you frank analysis about the news and the news industry. So let me do that right now. Public radio is at risk, but it's not just NPR and your local station. The American press writ large is in serious trouble. The people who cut our funding are afraid of fearless journalism. They're afraid of good information that they cannot control. They're afraid of rigorous reporting into their daily distortions and conflicts of interest. We, as public radio journalists, promise to be a bulwark for reality. But we need your help to do our best work and to stay on air. Please support this station by starting a monthly donation now. This is not a time to sit back. Thank you.
Give now at WJFFradio.org or on the Radio Catskill mobile app.
Yeah, your support sends a powerful message that trustworthy local news matters, that community connection matters, and the public media deserves a strong future. So donate now during our summer fund drive. We're at 85% of our goal. It's a $65,000 goal. We're just over $55,000. This final stretch is where we can get going some enthusiasm, some movement here to close this out soon. So call us at 845-482-4141. Go online to WJFFradio.org, or you can donate on the mobile app. Help us close out the summer fun drive. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And from dragonflies that fly like fighter pilots to catnip that may rival DEET as a mosquito repellent and a remarkable fungus that's thriving in one of the most radioactive places on Earth, our science guy, Joe Johnson, brings us some science stories that caught his eye.
The last time we were together, we talked about DEET and how researchers were actually investigating how DEET repels mosquitoes. They wanted to know the mechanism. Well, now we have new DEET news, actually alternate DEET news. This was a study that was recently presented at the Florence, Italy conference of the Society for Experimental Biology, and it's about an alternative mosquito repellent. Also, there were a couple of articles in the journal Scientific Reports. Now, the background here is that mosquitoes are the deadliest animal on the planet. Literally hundreds of millions of people are infected with a range of mosquito-borne diseases each year, and over a million people die from them each year. Malaria is the leading killer, with over 500,000 dead each year, and they're mostly children in sub-Saharan Africa. The answer seems simple, of course, use an effective repellent. However, in many parts of Africa, DEET-based repellents are just far too expensive for many people. You know, you have a lot of people who are subsistence farmers, and they just don't have the money. This study concerns an experiment that was conducted in Uganda about the use of a homegrown repellent called catnip oil. Catnip, by the way, is a member of the mint family, Nepeta cataria. It's pretty easily grown. And it contains a chemical called nepetic, I got to pronounce this correctly, nepetalactone. There you go, nepetalactone. That the plant apparently uses to dissuade insects from eating it. It's what's called an iridoid. It kind of irritates, okay? Now, researchers evaluated the repellent properties of nepetalactone, I got it that time, and found that it was highly effective at preventing mosquitoes from landing on human skin. Okay, and the advantage here, of course, is that the catnip repellent can be locally grown and produced. And in fact, local cooperatives can extract the oil, grow it, extract the oil, and produce a lotion a lot cheaper than DEET can be purchased. And one of the articles I read said that they were looking at starting local businesses that would be producing and selling the lotion in Africa,
helping to create a sustainable income for workers.
Right, right. The people who are running the business are certainly going to be making money doing it, and you have a nice income.
Yeah.
And they're going to be hopefully preventing a lot of deaths. Now, we don't have too many mosquito-borne diseases in the northeastern U.S. West Nile virus and eastern equine encephalitis are the two big ones. But the incidence of them is really, really low, just a few dozen cases each year. And I was thinking about our listeners who might not want to use DEET, that they could possibly create their own natural repellents using catnip. And by the way, a little research online told me that this stuff repels ticks as well.
Mm.
So we have a tick problem in our house. We have quite a few ticks. And I'm thinking about growing some catnip and just growing it around the areas that we're working in and see if maybe that would cut down on the ticks.
It's interesting how these natural botanicals, these natural remedies, I don't know if they're coming back or become rediscovered as these more commercially produced things seem to be becoming less effective. I remember the last time you were here, we were talking about DEET and how the effectiveness of that has been challenged or changed.
Oh, like I said, it's the gold standard.
Yeah.
And the problem is, like I said, it's just too expensive for a lot of people to be able to afford many parts of the world, many third world parts of the world, where malaria is a real threat.
It's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Let's talk about another story you've got for us. Inside Chernobyl, a fungus has been quietly feasting on radiation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Back to nature again.
Nature finds a way.
Yeah.
The last time I talked about Chernobyl, I was talking with Jason about it, and we were talking about black Chernobyl frogs, where evolution had caused the frogs to become black because the melanin was protecting them from the ionizing radiation. And he said that it sounded like an indie band name to him, Black Chernobyl. I think Black Chernobyl fungus is maybe.
That might be the better name.
Maybe a better name. So if you remember, the Chernobyl disaster back in 1986, reactor number 4 melted down and exploded, spread lots of very dangerous elements over a large area, about 58,000 square miles, were eventually included in an exclusion area and where people aren't supposed to go. Now, starting back in the 1990s, scientists and others visiting the reactor building noticed a fuzzy black fungus growing on the walls and apparently thriving in areas that were exposed to high levels of ionizing radiation. And ionizing radiation is the bad stuff. This is energy and high-speed subatomic particles strong enough to break chemical bonds between atoms. It's, can cause some real damage to living tissue, and it'll kill most living things at a high enough dosage. Now, the fungus in question here is Cladosporium spherospermum, and it's a fungus that grows worldwide. I guarantee you've seen it. Outdoors, it's found in the soil and on decaying vegetation. Indoors, it favors damp, moist, dark places like basements and crawl spaces. And it's also, however, known as an extremophile, meaning that it can grow in some pretty inhospitable places, places that are too dry or too salty for other fungi to grow. So it's a real survival.
Chernobyl is pretty inhospitable.
Yeah. And in the reactor, in the wrecked reactor building, it was actually found to thrive and grow more successfully in high radiation areas. And the question, of course, is, why is it doing
that? Have they been able to pin down why?
Well, they think the presence of the melanin in the fungus is a possible clue. You know, it's a very dark black color. When you see a picture of it, it's really dark. And that comes from an abundance of melanin in these fungi. And the question is, could it be harnessing the radiation and using it as an energy source? Could this be a form of radiosynthesis, similar to the way plants use photosynthesis to produce chemical energy using visible light or sunlight? One experiment's been carried out, and they actually took some of the stuff up aboard the ISS, the International Space Station, where it was tested as a potential way to shield astronauts from cosmic rays in space or even on the surface of Mars or the Moon. One of the problems with space travel is that there's a lot of energy in space, a lot of cosmic rays that are not very good. If you close your eyes on the ISS, you'll actually see little sparkles in your closed eyes, and that's high-energy ionizing particles going through your eyeball. And the astronauts actually report that all the time. So if we can, if somebody's going to spend a lot of time in space, they're going to have to be shielded from this stuff, or it's going to cause some real health problems. And it was demonstrated that a thin layer of the fungus was pretty successful at decreasing cosmic rays. So could this be used as a self-replicating radiation shield for space travel?
Mm.
And the other question that I have, and I think this is the question they need to answer, what are the exact metabolic pathways of the proposed radiosynthesis? We know how photosynthesis works. We don't know how this proposed radiosynthesis, it's not a fact, but it's an idea that scientists have right now and are testing out right now. How does this work? What are the pathways that the plant uses, or I should say the fungi uses the energy, the radiation, to turn into usable energy.
But they've studied this and they've written papers about it, but they still don't really know what the fungus is doing.
No, they don't.
Exactly.
Nope. No, they don't know how it's turning the radiation into usable energy. They don't know why it's thriving in this, you know, inhospitable, to use deadly environment.
Yeah.
Why is it still alive? Why is it, you know, thriving in this environment?
This idea of, is it called radiosynthesis?
Radiosynthesis, yes.
It's cool. And it could be potentially, if you figure it out, used for good, as you said, in space.
Sure.
And are there other places or applications where it could potentially prove beneficial?
I don't think you're going to want to use it for shielding here on Earth, because we have much better things like lead and stuff like that if you need to shield something from radiation. But in space, you know, weight is everything. And if we can bring a shield up there that will actually grow and self-replicate and self-repair itself, I think that's a great idea. Mm.
Fungus finding a way.
Life finds a way.
Life finds a way. And dragonflies have found a way to maneuver like fighter pilots.
Like fighter pilots,
wow.
Yeah. This was a great named article. The scientific article was in the Royal Society Interface Journal in July 1st edition. And it's named The Aerial Combat Strategy of Dragonflies. And that's like a great name for a paper. And I have to confess that I'm totally fascinated with dragonflies.
Oh, I am too. They're so cool.
Yeah. When this article came out, I was hooked. They are the world's most efficient and deadly pursuit predator. Lions, when they try and pursue prey, are successful 20 to 40% of the time. Cheetahs, 40 to 50% of the time. Dragonflies, 95 to 97% of the time. When they start chasing prey, they're successful that often at catching the prey. And you also have to remember that lions and cheetahs are working in a 2D world, right? They're just running over the surface of the earth, whereas dragonflies are catching insects in flight. So they're working in a 3D world. And it's just amazing to me that they can do this. They follow this. They typically approach their prey from below, and they follow a course that they constantly correct. They're flying this really complex curve that's calculated to make them appear motionless. And it's called motion camouflage. In other words, they fly at their prey so that the same background is always behind them, and this weird curve. And it's amazing to me that they can do this so quickly and so consistently. Now, that's not what the paper was about, though.
Right.
That's been known for a while. This is a new study about the male crimson marsh glider dragonfly found around the ponds at the Taipei Zoo in Taiwan. And this is, I have to say it, it's a gorgeous bug. It's this deep crimson magenta dragonfly, about 35 millimeters long, little under an inch and a half. So they're not really big dragonflies. And in this case, the scientists were like, they weren't studying predation, like I said. Instead, they were looking at territorial behavior. They were looking at how they fly in relationship to other dragonflies. The males are defending their mating territory from other males. So the researchers observed 102 dogfights, and that's what they called them. That's the nomenclature they used, between males of the same species. And they recorded them using these stereo videographic cameras, and then they were able to analyze the motion. And the flight patterns were totally different than predation. They constantly looped around each other in these tight little coordinated exchanges. If you watch the original video, you can't even see what's going on. But if they slowed the video down, and it's really interesting to watch them zooming around each other, they're constantly alternating roles between the pursuer and the evader.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The interloper that's coming in is trying to take over that territory, and the insect that's already has that territory is trying to defend it. And so they're constantly trading these roles. They each make these little hard acceleration course corrections, and they pull up to like 6 G's when they're doing this. And they follow them by these short little gliding periods, and then another hard acceleration, and another glide, another acceleration. Like I said, the video is really interesting to watch. Basically, they're trying to gain a tactical advantage over their opponent. And in the end, they're not trying to make contact. They're not trying to catch the opponent. They're trying to herd the opponent away from their territory so they can go back and wait for females to breed.
They're comparing this to fighter jets, because this is a similar thing that you see in aerial combat as you maneuver downward with like vertical spins or turns.
Yep, exactly. You're not trying to crash into the other plane. You're trying to gain an advantage over the other plane and force it out of the air or be able to get a shot on it. So it is very, very similar in that way.
Do they use altitude as this reserve maybe of energy as well, or do they?
No, actually, the thing is when they're preying on something, they actually come up from underneath it so that they have their prey silhouetted against the sky. In this case, they're actually just at about the same altitude or elevation as the interloper. And so they're, like I said, they're trying to herd it out of the way. They're trying to herd it out of there.
More about the visual advantage.
Right, yeah. Right.
Wow, very cool. I love it. And you know, in some traditions, the dragonfly is seen as good luck, mm-hmm. harmony, prosperity, mm-hmm. and now fighter pilot.
And they eat a lot of mosquitoes.
They're always good. I always love seeing a dragonfly on my property.
Yep. Yeah. Now, I do have one correction from the last time we were together. We talked about the ISS, and you had talked about what are they going to do with the ISS at the end of
the International Space Station.
International Space Station, right. In 2030, they are going to try to bring it down. And in fact, they just awarded a contract, hundreds of millions of dollars contract, to develop a spacecraft that will actually push it down. Now, last time we were together and talked about this, I said that they was going to crash it into the Atlantic, and I misspoke. They're actually going to try and bring it down in the South Pacific at a point called Point Nemo, which is the farthest piece of ocean from land in every direction. They've crashed like 300 different spacecraft there. The Mir spacecraft, Mir Space Station was crashed there. What else? Many satellites, Progress craft that went up to the ISS with supplies and stuff like that. They fill it with garbage and then they crash it into Point Nemo. The ocean there is like 13,000 feet deep. I had to look that up. And so they figure it's a good place because it's not close to any land. So bringing something down, even if they're a little off, they're not going to hit any land.
That's the place where they crash that stuff. You know, they should watch out for dragonflies when they're coming down. Joe Johnson, Science Stories. Thank you so much.
Always fun.
Quick break for us. And when we come back, a preview of the weekend of chamber music, which is this weekend. This is Radio Chatskill.
My name is Jasmine Garst, and I'm an immigration correspondent for NPR. Covering immigration right now is extremely challenging. A lot of the people I'm interviewing are hiding because they're too afraid to go outdoors. Something that I have really tried to focus on in my work is the humanity and the nuance and complexity of every human being, whether that is a 12-year-old girl trying to live her life in Minneapolis or a farmer in Florida. I think that we're at an inflection point in which we're really questioning our identity as a country, what we're okay with and what we're not. And that's something that I think is going to be a really big story this year. Your donation supports journalism that gets to the heart of the story. Please give today, and thank you.
Donate now at wjffradio.org.
Or call 845-482-4141 or on the new and improved Radio Catskill app. The Weekend of Chamber Music is back for another summer season, bringing internationally recognized musicians to Sullivan County for concerts that blend classical masterworks with contemporary compositions and conversations about the ideas behind music. This year's festival is built around the theme, My Brother's Keeper, and yes, there is a question mark, exploring the questions of compassion, justice, and our shared responsibility. Joining us now on Radio Chatskill to preview opening weekend and this year's festival is Andrew Wagner, co-artistic director of Weekend of Chamber Music. Hello.
Good morning.
And normally we would have our own classical Kit here to talk about things, all things classical, because she is the expert. Classical Kit is in the city welcoming a new grandchild, so congratulations. So, Andy, you will have to put up with me during this segment.
Oh, I think we can make it work.
Well, opening weekend is here. What our audience is going to experience as this year's Weekend of Chamber Music Festival gets underway?
Well, I think one thing they're going to experience is an incredible range of music, both in terms of period, historical period, but also just in terms of the sound of the instruments, because week one is on the modern instruments that most of us are accustomed to. Week two is all on what we call period instruments, which means simply instruments that are set up in the way that they would have been in the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries. And the sounds are quite different. And so the music comes alive in a way that it doesn't always on what we call modern instruments. And that's, of course, we won't get into the weeds with that. Suffice it to say, like lots of things, it's complex. My violin is a modern violin. It was made in 1753.
Oh.
Some of the period instruments that we'll be playing on were made, you know, a few years ago. So it's not a matter of exactly when they were made, but how they're set up, the shapes, the weight, the kinds of strings that are used, the shape of the bow, things like that. So week two is it's a little bit like being able to step into a time machine. And with that will come an approach to performance that's also different in some really cool ways. And in terms of the music itself, what it all has in common is that it all springs either from direct, explicit ideas of social justice, of compassion, of responsibility, as you said in your excellent intro.
No, thank you. I had to prepare dutifully without classical kid here.
You did beautiful. Or if it's not as directly concerned with those things, it's a music that, in terms of its affect, how it feels, how it makes us feel, is connected to that sort of larger range of issues.
Now, I mentioned the season's theme, My Brother's Keeper, question mark. Why the question mark? And what inspired that theme? And how does it shape the music and the conversations throughout the festival?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, the question mark is there because that's how it appears in the Old Testament. Am I my brother's keeper? Mm-hmm. And that question is a potent one that, you know, we've been asking ever since. And when it appears in the Old Testament, it's kind of snarky, right? What are you bothering me for? Mm-hmm. I don't look after him. Of course, what he's not letting on is that, you know, he's just iced his brother. So the question remains, what is our responsibility to each other? And you know, it's been a rough few years, the last couple of years in particular. And I think that one thing that's clear is that norms of behavior and norms around social responsibility, what we owe to our communities, what we owe to our friends and family, what we owe to people we disagree with, are all shifting and are under attack. And we thought it would be nice to spend two weekends plus two Thursdays, kind of basking in music that reminds us of the power of emotional connection, that asks questions about, social connection. And of course it does it all through music, which is abstract. And so there's no preaching. There's no sermonizing in it.
I was just going to ask, this is a way, it seems as if you can talk about issues that are affecting everyone, but it depoliticizes it.
It does. It does. Absolutely. Because the concerns, of course, are universal. Nobody, regardless of how you voted, you know, November a year ago, nobody is immune to this. Nobody is not affected by it. And everybody, I think, can benefit from spending some real quality time in especially in the second week on period instruments in a meditative space, just really pondering these issues through music that is really, really beautiful.
And one of the unique aspects of Weekend of Chamber Music is that audiences can attend rehearsals and pre-concert talks and conversations with artists. There's also a family programming and free events. Talk a little bit about some of those things and also why it's important to make the creative process part of the festival while also trying to attract folks who maybe have not attended a Weekend of Chamber Music.
More great questions.
Kit, look out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the things that we love most about the festival is that every year we have a composer in residence.
Trevor Weston this
year.
Yes,
Trevor Weston, who's a fabulous composer and a lovely human being, whose music is, I mean, Trevor's a kind of test case for what we want out of this festival. He's a composer first. He is always interested first and foremost in writing great music. And yet, at the same time, he's a composer who is drawn to themes of social justice and racial history and themes of oppression and liberation, but not in every piece. And so we'll have a chance to get to know Trevor really well Thursday night this week, so just tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. Folks can come to the Catskill Art Space and meet Trevor and have a chance to ask questions and hear some of his music, some of his solo and duo pieces performed in a context where the music is part of a conversation. And then on the concert on Saturday, we'll do two works of his for string quartet, one for quartet alone, the other for string quartet and narrator. And this is a piece based on an African-American folktale of liberation called The People Could Fly. And so that's for string quartet and narrator. And it's just fantastic. And then beyond that, there are the open rehearsals and the pre-concert talks before the big Saturday concerts. And we do those mainly because they're fun. And people really dig being able to be a fly on the wall while musicians are rehearsing. There's something about classical music in this country in particular, for lots of reasons that luckily for the audience, we don't have time to get into. But there's a, classical music tends to be shrouded in mystery. And classical music culture has, to some degree, aided and abetted that and made it seem as if performers are somewhat godlike, and composers in particular, busts on a piano. And of course, we're just people, right, making music together. And so when we perform in spaces like Catskill Art Space or the Nutshell Hall in Lake Huntington, where there is no stage. And you're right on the floor with us. And you can come to an open rehearsal and you can see us, warts and all, figuring out how to make this work. And it's we just really like doing it, and people seem to appreciate it.
In fact, you've described chamber music as something that speaks directly to people's lives and shared humanity, echoed in the theme this year. What do you hope someone who's maybe completely new to the music takes away after attending the concert, or for folks who are regularly attending Weekend of Chamber Music?
I think the single best thing that can happen is that you open yourself to an experience that may be unfamiliar to you, and that you are changed by it, that your relationship to all kinds of things, it can be a fundamental kind of, earth-shattering change, or it can be something very simple like, oh, it never occurred to me that Mendelssohn thought about his Jewish heritage in this way. And that can happen to people who have a lot of experience with classical music, or it can happen to people who have no experience with it. And in our case, all are welcome. Actually, many of our most loyal audience members over the last few years are people who do not have a classical music background, but they come and they find the experience powerful enough that they want to keep coming. And that, that makes us very happy.
That's Andrew Wagner, co-artistic director of the Weekend of Chamber Music. You can find the full schedule at wcmconcerts.org. And again, that talk with our composer in residence, Trevor Weston, is tomorrow, 7:30 at Catskill Art Space. Andrew Wagner, thank you so much. We should also mention that Weekend of Chamber Music is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill.
It is.
Have a good festival.
Thank you. Have a great fun drive.
Thank you.
Call. Sign up. Become a sustainer. It's important.
Thank you. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and do what he said, donate. Thanks. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at cfosrny.org.
and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
NPR and this station have always been powered by the people we serve, not by shareholders or special interests, but by people like you and me who believe in a free and independent press. It's been nearly a year since Congress eliminated federal funding for public media. Together, we continue the kind of journalism that we, the public, rely on. Please donate today, and thank you.
Give now at wjffradio.org or on the Radio Catskill app.
Help us close out the summer fun drive. We're 85% of the way there toward our goal, and we need your support. WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. There's an air quality alert in effect until midnight tonight due to smoke from Canadian wildfires. When pollution levels are elevated, the New York State Department of Health recommends individuals consider limiting strenuous activity.